The Reverend Peter Larmon's writing has always been incisive, witty, and articulate. His latest piece for Religion Dispatches, however, is also alarming. The term white manism is new to me, but it has already been dismissed by some as a too clever piece of academic wordplay. I can't blame anyone for getting distracted by semantics when the issue is so grave and as daunting as the wholesale campaign to redefine both religion and democracy in the service of a dwindling dominant majority. But I know Peter far too well to dismiss this analysis for that or any other reason. And so I'm pleased to welcome the Reverend Peter Larmon back to State of Belief Radio. Peter, thanks for joining us again.
A great pleasure to be back.
Let's dispense with the obvious here. We ourselves are both white men of a certain age, and there's a lot of privilege that's gone along with that accident of birth. So draw the line, please, between race and gender on the one hand and the political impulse of desperately preserving that privilege at all costs, which is what your piece is about.
Well, yes. I mean, I've waded into some fairly deep water here, and not with any regret, but there's been an interesting exchange since my piece appeared. And I'm going to publish not a correction exactly, but a clarification that race and gender can't be left out of any sound analysis of what's going to be required to be honest with ourselves and build our movement for change around clarity and honesty and reparation. There's no other word for that. So white manism, yes, struck some people as badly off because it emphasized racial domination over capitalism. And for a lot of people on the progressive side, it's like, well, we need to stop all of that racial focus because it's a distraction from the main business of bringing people together. But of course, if you don't bring people together honestly and with the reality of our history in the background, you can't get anywhere. It's actually the case, Welton, that white people in the 19th century in particular talked all the time about it being a white man's country, the necessity for maintaining white male power above all, and they did a pretty good job for themselves, if you think about it. Now, we tend to, you know, put that century in rose-colored glasses and say, well, it was a great century of democratic reforms and industrialization and, America being an exemplar to Europe. Yes, but all of that history has now come under question, and really for good reason.
The arguments that are being used today to attack any threat to white manism have evolved over time through trial and error. What's the core set of values or beliefs that undergirds this whole movement?
Yeah, well, it's that, in fact, white male power in the sweep of history has been a problem. It's caused immense amounts of suffering. It's based on a zero-sum idea that what I've got, what I can hold, what I can take, what I can grab is limited, right? It's based on an economy of scarcity. From a religious point of view, it's based on bad theology, we might say, right? Whereas theologically, we believe in shared abundance. We think there's more when you share. But that's not how white manism works. So it's possessiveness. Is a catastrophe, really, for other people and for the planet. So obviously, its time has come. A good friend talks about 500 years is enough. Well, 500 years is basically the run of white manism, and it, of course, corresponds to the colonial project in the Western Hemisphere.
What happened that caused you to say, I've got to write this piece?
Well, I'm worried. I'm worried. You know, I talk to a lot of people. I live near a university campus. I talk to a lot of very educated, sophisticated people, faithful media followers and so forth, who are not in the least worried now that Joe Biden and Kamala Harris are certified constitutional leaders. They feel the course has been righted. The nightmare of Trump and January 6th is now in the rearview mirror. I don't see it quite that way. I'm not a pessimist, but I don't underestimate the tenaciousness and the determination and the passion of the people in this heritage project, as they call it, right, who influence state legislators on voter procedures and also on gerrymandering. This is a long game, and when you have seemingly the entire Republican Party, with very few exceptions, committed to what is essentially an anti-democratic path, that's got to give you pause, I mean, I think. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sanguine about us being totally out of the woods. I mean, I'm delighted that we avoided the total apocalypse, but yeah, we've got a long way to go. The House is in play. The Senate is hanging by a thread. This so-called new day could be over, you know, in a
Peter, talk about the concrete ways you see race as the common theme of these different agendas for the political religious right.
So many ideas about gender relations, what we call patriarchy, turn out to be implicated themselves in a racialist, as Europeans would say, a racialist consciousness. So women's work is undervalued. Well, for a long, long time, a lot of women's work was actually black labor, and those things are related. So, for example, when the Wagner Act was passed in 1935, allowing organizing to go forward, the categories of work that were dominated by people of color were excluded. Race plays into the control of women's bodies. It plays into labor relations. It plays, honestly, into the environmental struggle, because if you look at the most powerful fossil fuel corporations and their friends, their legislative advocates, overwhelmingly white men. And then religiously, how Christianity plays into it. Well, I participated in the thing that Robbie Jones did with Kristen Dume, the scholar, about evangelicals and where they're at. They're all in. I mean, they're doubling down on this same sort of project of the election was stolen, therefore we need to disenfranchise people. It's a remarkable thing. It's not reality based, but it is reality based in if you accept that white manism is a reality in the culture. It's very much reality based in that sense, in that lamentable sense.
Peter, I'd like to ask you also to address the gender aspects of this, including the attempts to just erase the very existence of trans identities.
Yes. And I thank you for that, Welton, because, again, that's very deep water. But people talk sometimes about white fragility. There's also a kind of male fragility in our country. Many powerful men, again, white men, who actually have a fantasy life that involves crossing gender board, that involves gender fluidity. They're so panicked by that. You know, their sex panic is real. They're so panicked by that. And they're so intimidated by the religious ideation that they absolutely have to have a binary world. The cruelty of that is almost unimaginable if you really think about how it plays out. And I don't think it can stand indefinitely, but in the meantime, I'm told that there's now a backlash against the U.S. military because it's, you know, too soft on these and other matters, too willing to consider the appeals of trans people and, of course, the appeals of people of color for a more nuanced view of what the military enterprise is about.
So where does all of this lead us if these people get their way?
Are you familiar with The Handmaid's Tale? It's a pretty dystopian thing. I mean, the cases that the Supreme Court has agreed to hear, basically, I think starting with Mississippi, but you know the rest of them, are basically designed to simply open the door to state restrictions that will be instantaneous in more than half the legislatures. Many legislatures have a Me Too thing that's, you know, that's standing by. So if Texas does this, they'll do it too, right? Up to, you know, this issue of the heartbeat. I mean, it's really unbelievable. My life long, you know, I served at the Judson Church in New York. I'm associated with the people who, on the religious side, who talk about the dignity and judgment and moral autonomy of women, and therefore, you know, fought these horrific bans on not only abortion but reproductive health more broadly. And here we are at the brink of all of that being washed away. I don't know if people, you know, I guess, you know, we've got so many crises that bear down on us. It's hard to be clear on this one, but this would be more than catastrophic. I mean, it would be horrendous. It would take this industrial democracy and take us to the back of the line worldwide. What could we even say to other countries that have, you know, religiously informed repressive laws if we do this?
This may lead us into a redundancy because I'm going to ask a question that may take us right back there. All of this stuff is alarming. But what is the most urgent part of this, and are there any effective ways to push back?
There are, and many people are on this. I'm one of millions who say that the fight for the franchise, and it may be that HR1 is not the vehicle. I mean, people can debate that. Maybe that the John Lewis Act should have gone first. I'm not here to debate that. But the fight for the franchise broadly has to be the most basic, because without that, nothing else happens. Right? If we lose what we have of democracy, there's no way we can check corporate power. There's no way we can check fanatical religious repression. We can't do it. We are then utterly reduced to lack of agency. And lack of agency is, you see it all over the world, it's not a pretty sight.
So what's the role for faith leaders and faith communities here?
Faith communities are spaces where people can handle the truth, so to speak, right? They're safe spaces for truth-telling and for community despite difference. And they've got to be places where people are, you know, allowed to be both highly motivated to be part of change and unafraid. I think the gift of fearlessness in God's love, resting in God's love and resting in God's truth, is the greatest gift of faith communities. It's not always what they say and do. It's the spirit they enable that keeps hope alive. I really feel that strongly. And I really regret that a fair number of faith communities, now that they're, you know, kind of back open for business, are simply that, right? I mean, they're at the level of welcome back, but they're not at the level yet of welcome back, let's join the struggle.
Yeah. I can't let you go without asking for a few words on what you describe as flimsy liberalism in your headline. What is that?
Well, I think we've been talking about it, Welton. It's the rearview mirror, write a check, wave at Stacey Abrams, do a few things, and then thank God that's over, and thank God we can go back to normal life. that old Yeats line about the worst having passionate conviction and the best lacking passion. That's kind of our problem. I hosted a reunion of people who graduated from college 50 years ago. Most of us were activists. And it was amazing. We didn't change the world as much as we thought we did, but we had that kind of impulse. And people, without exception, because I talked to a number of the people who attended, without exception, are deeply, deeply worried still about where we are.
Reverend Peter Larman is ordained in the United Church of Christ and is the former executive director of Progressive Christians Uniting in Los Angeles, California. His urgent warning in Religion Dispatches is headlined, "The Coup That Never Ends, White Manism and the Perils of a Flimsy Liberalism," and we'll link to that from stateofbelief.com. Peter, it's great to be with you again, as always. Thank you for being on State of Belief Radio. Keep thinking like you think and writing like you write.
And you keep asking those questions, Weldon, because they're right on point. Thank you so much.